Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it is the 23rd of February 2012 for me here in Japan, and it is the 22nd back in Canada, where I'm honored to be joined on the line once again by Nick Wright, the president and CEO of GeopoliticalMonitor.com and an old friend of the Corbett Report. He's also an entrepreneur and a corporate lawyer based in Toronto, Ontario, and he's a passionate advocate for democratic accountability, and he believes that an informed citizenry is essential for a peaceful and prosperous planet. He holds an honors BA in political philosophy from the University of King's College Halifax and law and MBA degrees from Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. So, Nick Wright, it's excellent to have you on the program again. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me, James.
Well, Nick Wright, please tell us a little bit about what happened at the Toronto G20 and your experience of that back in 2010.
Well, it seems like a long time ago now. Back in June of 2010, the G20 summit took place here in Toronto on the 26th and 27th of that year. It was a meeting of international leaders to essentially discuss global policy while ignoring the democratic will, not just of Canadian citizens, but of the citizens of many other countries. Notably, the government of China was represented. So there was a lot of concern, not just about what was being discussed, but whether or not the voice of the people and a democratic voice was going to be heard, or whether policy was going to be imposed on people both in Canada and abroad without their consent and vote.
Absolutely. There were so many different violations of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms and just other rights generally that were taking place during the Toronto G20. And as I understand, you had your own personal experience with some of that. Tell us about your own experience of the G20.
I did. So what we saw in the Toronto G20 is what you see at most large-scale demonstrations, at least in Canada and probably North America. And that's whenever there's sufficient budget and import to bring in the police consultants and the protest police from abroad or from elsewhere in the country. What you see is the first day, there are agents provocateurs, police dressed up as protesters will incite violence, vandalize and break things, or the police will promote or allow others to do that without intervening. And then the second day of the event, they carry out mass unconstitutional arrests of anyone that they deem to be speaking out against the status quo. And what we saw in Toronto was just what we see at other similar events. The first day, we saw police cars being left out, abandoned in the march route, likely trying to incite people to damage the cars, to attack them, which some did. There was video footage of police cars on fire because they were abandoned. There's also a group of people who went and broke some windows in downtown Toronto. And all throughout, despite there being a $1 billion budget and certainly hundreds of police everywhere, they didn't have the will to prevent their police cars suspiciously abandoned from being burned, or preventing a small group of people who may or may not have included police from breaking some windows on Yonge Street, which is one of the main streets in Toronto. So the second day, predictably, they carried out targeted mass profiled arrests. They essentially suspended the Constitution. Here in Canada, we have the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which prevents unlawful, unreasonable detainment and arrest. They, in effect, declared martial law unofficially and went about arresting anyone that they saw as being a protester. So to give a little bit of context of my experience was much less severe than most people's. Many people were violently attacked by police, beaten up. Chemical weapons were used on citizens expressing their concern. My experience the second day was simply being stopped and arrested while riding my bicycle on Bloor Street, which is probably a 40-minute walk from where the actual event was taking place. So this is a completely different area of downtown Toronto, but apparently the order was out. Anyone who fit their profile was to be arrested. And in my case, I had a bandana tied around my neck, and that went against the fashion rules of the police that day. And I, along with a number of other people who were wearing bandanas, were arrested. But my experience was a little bit different in that I asserted my rights. I remained silent. I requested the name and badge number of the officer, and as a result, I think that coupled with the fact that I was articulate and they found my lost side ID card in my wallet when unlawfully searching me. They ended up letting me go, and I was on my way. But most people were taken to the detention center and kept for many hours in small cages in very harsh conditions.
Absolutely. Well, funny how they back off as soon as they realize they have someone who could actually fight back legally. But very interesting. So I understand that you filed a complaint right away regarding your arrest.
I did. So there's two ways of complaining or taking action against police who act unlawfully. And the first method is the internal disciplinary process. There's an organization called the Office of the Independent Police Review Commission. So I and a number of other people who were arrested or faced unlawful action by the police filed a complaint, and took about a year for the investigative report to be completed. And I must say, despite some shortcomings of this independent commission, the investigator in my case did an exceptional job and was able to identify the officer despite the fact that he gave a fake name at the time of the incident. They were able to track his login code on the car computer where he did a search, criminal background search, my ID, and they found his true name. And as a result, it's going to a formal disciplinary hearing in the internal process. And I, just this past Thursday, have launched a civil suit suing civilly the police officer and the police board for breach of charter rights, that's our constitutional rights, false arrest, and negligent investigation.
Well, that is excellent to hear that that perhaps accountability will be had in some small way in this case, in this egregious violation. So what specifically are the charges that this officer will be facing?
Well, there's the potential for internal discipline. Unfortunately, we've seen other instances where police have been caught attacking people, breaching internal policy. They've gotten just a slap on the wrists, docked a day's pay and whatnot. So I'm not too hopeful that even if found culpable, which I think they likely will, the officers in question will face any severe punishment. And likewise, unfortunately, with the civil action, it will probably be, dealt with, settled prior to. So, the disappointing element of all of this is that there's really not accountability. And just a small percentage of the people who faced police action, unlawful police action, actually pursued it. And, it'll all just be kind of swept under the rug. So it's my hope that with the continued action of individuals seeking recourse, both in the internal process and civilly, and a class action lawsuit that is seeking to be approved, which would cover everyone who doesn't have the capacity to make the complaint or suit individually. Hopefully that will, if nothing else, provide a financial incentive not to suspend the Constitution, in effect, implement martial law, and, do as they will anytime there's a large international gathering. So hopefully at some point, probably not for a number of years still, there'll be some at least financial recourse, and that will be in the minds of politicians and police down the road when the next event is being planned.
Well, one would certainly hope so. But as you point out, obviously, your law background does give you somewhat of an advantage over a lot of the people who were arrested who are intimidated by the legal system and don't believe there is really any recourse, so they didn't bother trying. So hopefully shining more attention on stories like this one will at least remind people that there are recourse to when things like this occurs. What can you say to the process itself and how difficult it is or how easy it would be for people who have had their rights violated similarly to do the same thing?
Well, I think the difficulty is that the process, the internal investigation process from the Office of the Independent Police Review Commission is a little bit more accessible. So it wouldn't be too difficult for someone who experienced difficulty with the police to file a complaint. The difficulty is that there's not a lot of accountability, at least not in the context of the G20. And certainly for a lawsuit, it's much more involved. And realistically, you'd probably have to go to the expense of hiring a lawyer to take that avenue. And there's really not much potential. The monetary damages are limited. So unfortunately, there's not a lot of accountability. And I think the true accountability has to come at the political level, with people speaking out against what happened and making sure that it's a political issue and that when the next election comes around, there's accountability. And I think there has been some degree of that. Some of the major newspapers here in Toronto and Canada have been covering the issue very closely. And certainly the police have gotten a real black eye over the past year with case after case after case of abuse and unlawful conduct. But to what effect there'll truly be accountability, it's hard to say. And probably next time around, they'll behave in exactly the same way, which is unfortunate.
Well, if the people don't hold them accountable and put the feet to the fire, then certainly nothing will happen. That we know for sure. So tell us a little bit more about the background of how they were attempting to assert the right to take away people's rights and freedoms under the Charter through the invocation of, I believe, a World War II era piece of legislation called the Public Works Act.
What happened was, in my mind, incredibly egregious in that politicians, including the premier of the province and some of the main members of provincial parliament, colluded in secret to pass what they, I'm sure, were completely aware are unconstitutional regulations pursuant to the Public Works Act, this old legislation that hasn't been used for some time. And just by way of background, Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms was implemented just in 1982. So it's a fairly new constitution as it pertains to human rights. And there is legislation that predates that the courts either have or would most obviously find to be unconstitutional and inconsistent with the rights that have been enshrined in that document. And there's no question that the Public Works Act, and especially this regulation that they passed, would be contrary to the Charter. And what was particularly shocking was the fact that they first implemented this regulation they knew was illegal, and then they kept it a secret. They didn't tell anyone about it, and they didn't release the regulation to the public leading up to the event. And thirdly, when they did share the information with the police, who made the information public, either the politicians or police or a combination thereof misrepresented the regulation and in fact made up their own law, saying that anyone within a certain distance from the fence was breaking the law and would therefore be arrested. So it's shocking behavior both by the police, who misrepresented the law and enforced what they too knew was an unlawful regulation, and the provincial politicians who colluded with federal politicians to implement this unlawful regulation, knowing that it was a breach of the Charter rights.
Absolutely. The only thing more egregious than the breach to Charter rights that took place under that the interpretation of that legislation was the lack of response from a number of Canadians. Any Canadian who is not outraged at this, I think, is probably not paying attention. But let's back up to some of the context of this, because as you mentioned before, the possibility of using agent provocateur, specifically in the now famous images of the Toronto G20 of the police cars on fire, is always a present one. And that's said advisedly. That's not just made up out of a whole cloth. There are precedents for that. Perhaps you can talk about some of the precedents for using agent provocateur in situations like this.
Well, my personal experience prior to the G20 in Toronto was in Montebello, Quebec, where there's a meeting of Bush, Calderon, and Harper to discuss North American trade. And I went out to Montebello to participate in demonstrations to express concern about the policies being put forward, especially when at least two of the leaders weren't actually elected by the populace. And in that instance, it was very clear, and in fact, it was admitted that agent provocateurs were used. And what happened is there were two large, burly men in their 30s with kind of a sneer of disdain on their face, which always is a bit of a giveaway when it comes to spotting police out in the crowd dressed as civilians. But they were captured on film, dressed in black, covering their faces, holding large rocks, threatening people there who were there, who were, you know, an older gentleman. You know, it's kind of the full family crowd, young people, old people, the whole gambit. And they were trying to incite violence with these rocks. And when a prominent union leader who was at the event called them out and identified them as police and agent provocateurs, they disappeared behind police lines and were, you know, brought down to the ground and then taken away. But what the video showed was that they were wearing the exact same police-issued boots as all the other police. And after media controversy, the police finally did admit the fact that they were, in fact, police that were carrying out the behavior. They tried to argue that threatening people with rocks was trying to promote safety and not trying to incite violence. But there was evidence. There are also other demonstrations and events where there's been the same story that I haven't participated in directly. The Seattle protest of a number of years ago is a big one. And there's reports of, again, either permitting or actively being involved in violence and damage on the first day, and then using that as a justification to carry out illegal mass arrests on the second. So for anyone who is involved politically and attends demonstrations or events and who pays attention, has been around for a little while, this pattern becomes very apparent, and it's quite clear that it's standard protocol and to be expected.
Given that such events as the 2007 Montebello protest, Agent Provocateur incident, have now been fully admitted and are on the record, and given the fact that there has been so little protest from the Canadian public about that, and seemingly not so much movement on the Toronto G20, although there was a little bit more protest regarding the treatment of people during that that particularly egregious affront to human liberties. But given that the Canadian public does not at this point seem mobilized to really counter these threats to liberty, are you optimistic that we can really mount some sort of force for true accountability and to make sure that this type of event won't happen again?
Well, I think that it likely will happen again. And hopefully the response after the G20 this time and future incidents will be sufficient to at least curtail the behavior by politicians and police. I think the fact that politicians and police work as a single unit, whereas demonstrators and citizens work as many different groups with a broad variety of issues and tactics, puts the police at an advantage. So they can strategize about how to effectively get media that will convey their message, which is that anyone that opposes status quo policies is a violent person and that they should be discounted. And that's what they've effectively done by showing violence on the first day. The media love it. They get good coverage and justifies their behavior on the second day. So, you know, I don't think things will change fundamentally, but I think that if we work to hold police accountable, try to work to raise media awareness of police tactics and try to hold people accountable generally, it will mitigate and reduce the behavior both amongst police and politicians in future events. But it's an ongoing battle and there's a back and forth, and where that pendulum will end up depends to a large extent the pressure that citizens place on politicians and the extent to which people involved in demonstrations hold police and politicians accountable afterwards.
Well, Nick Wright, on behalf of Canadians like myself, I want to thank you for standing up for your rights and attempting to get some accountability in your own way. And once again, thank you so much for all of that. So Nick Wright, geopoliticalmonitor.com, thank you for your time.
Thanks, James.